Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and once again, I am so happy to be communicating with the best audience in the entire field of psychology, psychiatry, mental health, and so on and so forth. All of life. And my guest today is a real all of life man. He's a really dear friend of mine. I'll tell you his name, but I'm not going to bring him on yet. I'm going to have him listen to my introduction. But his name is Bob Nickel. Bob's a social worker. Are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, I'll tell a little about you, and then I'm going to talk about something that's on my mind. We'll let Bob comment, and then we'll go on into a whole bunch of new things he's been writing about on Mad in America, which if you don't know the Mad in America website, you should get to know the Mad in America website. Bob, we've known each other for years. He's on the Executive Committee for Excellence in Mental Health. His wife, Gina, is in charge of it. I think that's fair to say. She's in charge of it. Bob and I were joking. We're one of the few men we know who actually admit that our wives are more intelligent than we are. Bob has had all kinds of interesting establishment positions, from which he's done about as much good as a man can do. He was for a time, believe it or not, when you hear him, you won't believe it, but he was for a time the Commissioner of Mental Health and Addiction for the state of Oregon. He is working on a project now at Mad in America that we'll talk about, the continuing education program, where people who are very highly critical of establishment views, like Peter Gertzeff, my friend Peter from Europe, is presenting, and of course Bob Whitaker himself and many others. So that's an amazing program that I will tell you about. They probably haven't had me yet deliver any CME credit courses there because they don't want their program to be killed on the spot. So I'm sympathetic with their going and having a variety of very critical people talk right up to the edge of me, but not to me. A couple of times, by the way, when I've done very big CME programs, they've lasted about once. I've told folks in these programs that, you know, you're really risking getting into a lot of trouble. And they say, no, we can handle it. But in general, I'm getting more and more content with my role, which is having inspired almost everybody else who is doing activities in the field. One of the wonderful things I keep learning and being astonished by on the show is how often someone who I see doing something good, whom I've never heard of, I have on this show, and they read Toxic Psychiatry. That's usually the starting point, or heard me or saw me someplace. But I'm feeling a little nostalgic today. I yesterday put up on Mad in America a blog, which I think is so important. And I think I so nailed it. I'm going to do something I haven't done before. I'm going to read to you a little bit from the blog. And first I'll give you the background. Well, no, I'll read right to you, right from the start. But I'm only going to read for a minute or two. Here's how it begins. This is a blog on Mad in America, and it's already had over 2,000 people look at it. And it's got real good discussion going on, intense discussion. I think it's helping people really say what they think, which is, I think, one of my major roles in life is to say what I think, and then other people feel more comfortable saying what they think. The blog begins with a fact. With the endorsement of her psychiatrist, a Dutch woman in her 20s was recently, quote, allowed to die by assisted suicide. That is, she was killed by her doctors. This occurred after the failure of, quote, intensive treatment to cure her of the trauma of child abuse. So let me get this exact for you. A woman in her 20s who had serious enough child abuse to be very distressed and anxious, and then to seek help from doctors, psychiatrists, and who got intensive treatment, which we know is a form of abuse. If you see the words, folks, intensive treatment in regard to psychiatry, my gosh, it probably means ECT, and it certainly means multiple psychiatric drugs, which would prevent any man or woman in their 20s from recovery. So first we have a person abused by folks. We don't know if it's family or we don't have the information, but abused badly enough to end up in the psychiatric network. She then gets, quote, intensive treatment, which is always a horror in psychiatry. And then what do they do? Oh, surprise. She's not getting better. Most people get worse with psychiatric treatment, that is drugs and shock. And all people, in my experience, get worse with intensive treatment. They all get worse with intensive treatment. Ruins your brain function. How are you going to get better when you got multiple drugs or shock treatment ruining your very delicate, marvelous, incredible brain and its functioning? So having made her sick and sicker, and having discouraged her and robbed her of hope, my colleagues, in this case, in the highly sophisticated land of Holland, the Dutch, my colleagues participate in declaring her incurable, which then allows doctors to participate in killing her. In killing her. I wrote a paragraph I want to read to you now. The tragic irony in respect to the victims of child abuse is truly beyond words. How does one describe the horror of a profession that takes over the lives of people wounded by abuse, then further abuses them, and finally participates in killing them in the name of euthanasia? Victims of child abuse can be helped, but not by biological psychiatry, which discourages them and compromises their brain. On their own sometimes, often with the loving support of others. Even the most dreadful victims of child abuse have gone on to live worthwhile lives, sometimes becoming leaders in publicizing child abuse and in rejecting the continued abuses of psychiatry. My own life and work has been inspired by Louise Armstrong, Kiss Natty Goodnight, David Peltzer's A Child Called It, people who not only survived but triumphed over abuse despite psychiatry. Then I'm going to read again a little bit, and then I'll finish. Psychiatry's inability to help its patients led to the lobotomy and electroshock in the 1930s, both of which are still with us. Worse yet, nearly all contemporary victims of electroshock and lobotomy were already being made worse by years of psychiatric abuse in the form of drugs and discouraging diagnoses. Originally, most of these brain-damaging treatments were inflicted within the confines of state mental hospitals, where victims were routinely subjected to isolation, humiliation, toxic chemicals, and finally to be subdued with lobotomy, shock, and early death. I want to conclude with a the sentence I wrote at the end. One is a paragraph, and this is it. I want you to listen. This, I put my heart and my years of experience into this. One is tempted to say that psychiatrists are playing God. But is that true? Would God, as best understood, looking down upon a suffering victim of child abuse, and then declare the person better off dead? Would such a God fulfill the purposes of the abusers by forever silencing their victims? Or would a loving God expect all of us to rally around this individual with empathy and wisdom while devoting ourselves to ending child abuse? Psychiatrists who injure people and then declare them incurable and call for their deaths are not playing God, they are playing psychiatrist. It is time to stop psychiatry from killing off the victims after failing to help them and make them worse, while making them worse off. Whoa, you see, I have a lot of feeling about this. Hello, Bob, again. Bob Nickel, my friend. Your thoughts on this blog of mine on MIA, Madness in America.
I have several thoughts, Peter. One is, ethnically, I'm Dutch. Peter knows this. I'm 6'8", and I'm from the... Originally, my family came from Friesland, which I understand has the tallest people on average in the world. And I guess even though my family hasn't been there for several hundred years, I guess I'm still genetically cut out like that. And so I'm ashamed that anybody from the place that my family came from would do this. It's appalling. It's horrible. Peter, I don't think anybody could have said it better than you did. So that's my first reaction. Embarrassment. Glad that you're... unfortunately, you're the lightning rod for so much of what's gone wrong in psychiatry. I had to think about my own experience with psychiatry. Part of my background is spiritually... I grew up as a Mennonite, and Mennonites during World War II were largely pacifists, and they went into state hospitals and they came back horrified by the kind of things, Peter, that you've described over and over and over. So they attempted to do a psychiatric reform movement, and a number of psychiatric hospitals were created, and I think originally with good intentions. But I have to tell you that when I went to work in one during the Vietnam War, I saw some of the same authoritarian things that were going on there that were going on in state hospitals. Maybe they weren't as dramatic. We weren't doing lobotomies. We were doing electroshock treatments. And I know that when I began to raise questions about it and wondering whether this was consistent with the Mennonite heritage, I was in a lot of trouble. I nearly got myself fired in the first job I ever had. So those are some, you know, personal reactions, Peter, to what you wrote. And again, I don't think anybody can say it with more authority than what you're saying it. So I'm one who's been an admirer of you for years, and this just continues that pattern for me.
Now, you worked in these state mental hospitals of Oregon a number of years ago. It must have been very difficult for you to be in those circumstances and try to make them better. Did you have any success in making them better?
Yeah, okay, great questions. First, I should clarify that I didn't actually work in them as a clinician. I was in charge of them for 6 years.
Yep. 6 years, you said?
Yeah, during my tenure as State Mental Health and Addictions Commissioner. So I was in and out of them as a manager, as a key leader. I will tell you, one of the things that I'm most proud of is I got all of the kids and adolescents out of our state hospitals. I just felt like that wasn't ever appropriate to have kids and adolescents in
I've never applauded on the air before. That's applause worthy. You actually got them out of those places.
Yeah, and, you know, partly I had worked in the community mental health system for years before all of this. Let me take a quick detour. In my own defense, I want to say I was the accidental commissioner. I never applied to the job. I didn't interview for it. I didn't want it. I turned it down when they came to me. And they sort of tricked me into it. They said, Bob, if you'll do it for 3 months, we'll find somebody else. And 3 months later, they came to my office and said, you're it. I decided by then I might as well give it the best shot I can, knowing that I would probably compromise myself a number of times. And I will be the first to admit that I did that. I'm not proud of it, but I wish I'd closed the entire state hospital. One of the problems in Oregon was that we were we had a state hospital that was still employing buildings that had been built 100 years before, and they had been deteriorating badly. So I guess I can say this publicly now. I was kind of a deep throat to Oregonian journalists who were writing articles about the conditions of our state hospital, and I was feeding them accurate information behind the scenes. If that had been known at the time, I'd have been fired a lot sooner than I was. But the journalists, Doug Bates and Rick Attig, actually won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigative journalism. And when they accepted the prize, I got a call from them later, and they said, you know, Bob, we're sorry, but we outed you a little bit. We gave you some credit for helping us get accurate information. We rebuilt the state hospital. It's at least a cleaner, better place in terms of the architecture, but we still have a state hospital. In Oregon, most of the patients now are there because their attorneys pled that they were guilty except for insanity, and then they're assigned to a state agency called the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Attorneys can plead that they need evaluation. They're unable to proceed with the trial because they are likely to have a mental illness. And so those are most of the people who are left in Oregon State Hospitals. I will also say that one of the issues that I worked on even earlier than being named Mental Health and Addictions Commissioner was getting people out of the state hospital. And we mostly were able to get people out of our civil commitment units, and we created community placements, a whole variety of community placements, everything from supported community independent living all the way up to some of the facilities were locked. So we had been working in that area, and we closed a very dangerous state hospital in Oregon and created places for people. So we didn't put a single person out on the streets. And over time, I think we probably have, I'm guessing, probably 1,500 community placements for people as alternatives to the state hospital. So I'm going on maybe longer than I should, but my work in the state hospitals was basically to try to get people out of them as much as I could.
You're not going on longer than you should. Did you, in looking back in retrospect now over a period of time, I have two questions. One, did many of these accomplishments stay in place? And two, do you think you did more good than harm by spending your time there and lending your good and kind name to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer the first question, yes. I think that all of the programs that we created during that period of time, which is now getting close to 10 years and longer, they're all out there functioning, and most of them we've increased most of those types of programs. The children and adolescent program, that's continued on, and I've stayed in touch with the executive director. I'm working with him on some other projects right now. But they're very proud of what they are doing, and they've continued to operate the children and adolescent programs in the community settings. And I know they feel real good about what they did, and I'm proud of them for sticking with it and doing a good job.
That's terrific. That's surprising and pleasing. And I know from our private conversations that some good people are in those places now that you helped build. So that's really, really good. Now, what do you feel in retrospect? I mean, I'm kind of hearing, even though you voiced a little embarrassment about having been the Commissioner of Mental Health and Addiction, that you feel that you actually got some good done and it was best that you did it?
I think I got some good done overall. I see some of the shortcomings, though, still. You know, we created these community programs, and we discharged people from state hospitals but I think sometimes they continue to be ghettoized in communities. I actually live on the grounds of the state hospital I helped close 20 years ago. And there are a number of the advocates. NAMI was very unhappy with us, even though...
Well, then you did a great job. If the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which, folks, is AstroTurf, that is, it's not really grassroots, it's created by the drug companies, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. They have I was perhaps the first to broadcast just how much money they were getting from the drug companies, and they have violently attacked me in the past. So if NAMI was really angry, you were doing a good job.
Well, I think we did the right thing. I have no question that we needed to close that particular state hospital. There was actually an 18-year-old Native American boy who was in the hospital, and he was killed in a seclusion restraint incident using a hospital-approved policy called the Bums Rush. The Bums Rush. So when I think back, and I wasn't commissioner when that happened. That was under somebody else's watch. But it was absolutely the right thing to do. What NAMI did was actually ended up being something kind of good. I hate to say
that's
that
all right.
In some ways, but they got a bill.
I can handle it. Go ahead.
They got a bill passed through the Oregon legislature that required setting aside up to 10 acres for housing for people with mental health issues on the same grounds where the state hospital was. They believed we closed it because we wanted to make a big real estate deal and make a lot of money. That was absolutely untrue, but that's what they believed. So they were able to convince the legislature to set aside land to develop community placements for people. So that was good. There are five such places now in the community that I actually live in. Some of them are literally around the corner from my house. What I can tell you, though, is that as I look at it as a neighbor and as a resident, I don't think those people are very well integrated in the community. Most of them seem to me on large amounts of medications. They walk around. Most of them are not walking very well. They look down at the ground most of the time. I've been able to make acquaintance with some of them. So although we have community placements, I'm not entirely convinced that we've done it the right way either. So to me, there's always room for improvement, and that's an aspect of things that I wish I had been more on top of when I was in the commissioner role.
Well, you're an amazing man in your ability to make friends across the spectrum of viewpoints and to be able to, over the years, to have worked with and managed in situations where I'd lose my temper on day one and be ineffective. And again, now working with Bob Whitaker and developing new programs to Mad in America. Would you like to talk about that? I kind of tweaked you a little bit about the fact that I've never been asked to present myself to do a program with you on that, but I actually understand why, and I don't really recommend you do me, but I just lost control of myself and tweaked you a little about it. Tell folks about the program.
Well, first of all, Peter, I don't mind that you tweak me, because I think tweaking is really necessary in this world, even among those of us who are well-intentioned and trying to do the right thing. So that's something I've always appreciated about you, is your willingness to put yourself out on the line. And for me, that's fine. You know, Peter, that I have you on my short list, though, okay? So one of my goals is to get the green light for you to do a course.
Well, I think it's hazardous, but you have had Peter Goetze on, and Peter is on target, I think, as much as I am. I think he's the first physician. He's a researcher, and his basis is internal medicine. He's an amazing man. He's world renowned for programs he's created to evaluate scientific studies. And then he got around to looking at psychiatry studies and realized what an atrocity it is. And Peter speaks out as strongly as I do, but he's not yet the target I am, because A, he's in Europe, and B, he's just been doing this a few years. I won't be surprised if you get some flack for having him in your program for teaching. Tell people what you're doing with this this program where docs get credits for hearing your people.
That's correct. And Peter's course is one of the most recent ones that we've put up. And yes, people can, social workers, psychologists, et cetera, can get continuing education units. And doctors, not just psychiatrists, but physicians of all different kinds can get their CME credits. And we're trying to be very reasonable in our costs. We're, for one unit of credit, it's $15. And these are all online courses. And so they're all taught by people who are mostly world known. Peter is probably, you're right, one of the most challenging of people that we put up as a course. His title, get this, is Why Few Patients Benefit from Psychiatric Medications. He does a review of the unbiased research on the effectiveness and risks of psychiatric medications. He's an amazing guy. Peter, I think very much in the mentality and the skills and the knowledge that you've demonstrated for decades. And I think, too, he hasn't become as much of a target because he hasn't been at it as long. But
he's been assaulted. For some reason, I'm blocking on his home country. It's reminding me where Peter's from. I know very well. I write to him all the time, but I can't remember what country he's from.
Yeah, he's in Denmark.
Denmark. Wonderful, yeah. Beautiful Denmark. But he has come under pretty heavy attack in Denmark already.
Well, that's inevitable.
But say more about the program. I think it's a huge breakthrough. I just think that you and Bob working together, managing to set up a program that gets these credits, gets accredited, and then professionals can get their professional credits to keep their licenses and so on. I think it's really great. Say more about it.
Well, we got to start about 2 years ago, and we felt that there really wasn't a good online. In fact, there aren't very many great resources for getting information that comes from unbiased, good scientific research on the key topics like long-term outcomes. One of our first courses, it was by Dr. Martin Harrow. Dr. Martin Harrow is a legendary not a psychiatrist, he's a psychologist. He has been studying long-term outcomes for 30 years at the University of Illinois Chicago School of Medicine. Martin is a very interesting guy, Peter. I'm sure you've met him.
I've had him on my show.
Yeah, okay. You probably know this. He's a chess master, and I'm told he's played Bobby Fischer to a tie on five different occasions. A delightful man. I had several nice emails from him just this week. He's continuing his research, and I'm hoping that we can have another course by Martin before terribly long. He's doing research now that looks at the effects of psychiatric medications on long-term outcomes. And the picture is pretty much, Peter, what you've been saying all along. So it'll be interesting to see. He's submitted some papers for publication. As soon as he gets them and I get them, I'll share them with you.
That's really great. One of the things we talked about on the show is that his work has been so good. I mean, his work is the best follow-up work we have, I believe. And it does show basically that the more medicine you have, the more antipsychotic drugs you have, the worse you end up, the less you have, the better you end up. And it's not because of who gets the drugs originally. It's about the drugs, not about your condition. And what he told me on the air, as I recall, is that NIMH had cut off his funding. And isn't that amazing? Here you have the best research in the world that shows the drugs are doing more harm than good long term. And what does our grand agency of the federal government do? Cuts off its funding. Now, your organization, it has funded him some, hasn't it? Isn't it giving him some help and encouragement?
Yes, that's right. And in this case, the other organization that I've been involved with from the beginning is the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. And you've had my wife, Dr. Gina Nickel, on your program, and she's the CEO and president. But yes, you're right. The foundation has funded Martin Harrow's research the last couple of years. And I know that he's looking to see if maybe we can find some more funding to continue some more of his studies. So if anybody's out there that has $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 or even less than that, we'd like to hear about it because we would like to continue to fund Martin Harrow. I think he's doing absolutely critical work. You know, he's 85 years old, and he's still just as sharp as anybody I've talked to. Just an amazing human being.
Well, I second that, folks. I mean, they're, I think, just supporting the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health in general is a good idea. And earmarking help for Martin Harrow, of course, is a great idea as well. We are a member. I'm not asking for any money for us. I literally am not asking for any money for us. But I do want to acknowledge that we are also a part of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health. Just as an aside, but it's also very central. I've never talked about this, but I have always funded all of my reform work myself. And the organizations I have created, including within the last decade, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, and earlier than that, the International Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, I've funded that. And me and Ginger together, since we've been together, have funded the organizations that we've created. So I'm not asking for any help, but I think helping the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health is the best possible way anybody with money could go. They want to help change what's going on in the world today in terms of psychiatry and mental health.
Well, thank you, Peter. That means, you know, so much. You know this coming from you to have that kind of support for what we're doing. I should probably mention another project that the foundation has been very involved with, and I think is one of the key reform approaches, and that's the Hearing Voices Network. We just had a training up here. I live in the Portland, Oregon area. We had a training a couple of weeks ago up here with some of the international trainers for Hearing Voices Network approaches. And it was focused on United States veterans who've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan hearing voices that they never heard before they left. And a lot of this is due to the severe traumas that they experienced, saw witnesses, the horrible things that I won't even talk about on the air, but they began hearing the voices of people that they saw killed in war. And so this whole Hearing Voices Network, which has been going strong in the United Kingdom for, 30 years, is now beginning to catch on here in the United States. And I think we have about 15 chapters of Hearing Voices Network that the foundation has been trying its best to find ways to sponsor. The way we're doing that right now is to sponsor trainings.
It's another, folks, another marvelous movement, the Hearing Voices movement, or the Voice Hearers. And I've been friendly with them and supported them, but from quite a distance. I've never, somehow or other, I've never gotten involved directly in any of their conferences. Maybe they don't want any psychiatrists in their conferences, but they're a wonderful group. And the other group that the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health is supporting is the Open Dialogue group out of Finland. I'm going to let Bob Nickel tell you more about them rather than my giving a little mini lecture about it. But again, I want to tie this into just how corrupt our federal government representing organized psychiatry is, and that they have refused to fund the best, most documented treatment program in the world for people who are having so-called schizophrenic or psychotic breakdowns. There's no comparison. It's the best studied and known to be the most effective that anybody has examined and reported on of all programs. It comes out of the tradition of the psychotherapy and family therapy of people labeled schizophrenia. Lauren Mosier, who's no longer with us, his successful Soteria House, I think, helped inspire them. And my dear friend Bertrand Caron, now retired professor emeritus at Michigan State in psychology. Bert has had a great influence on them in the beginning. So, again, I'd love to have you just talk a little bit about what you're trying to do in helping the open dialogue, folks.
Yes, the foundation was able to secure funding to help Dr. Chris Gordon in Framingham, Massachusetts, start a program that's really an adaptation of the Finnish model. Just because something works well in Finland doesn't necessarily mean it works well in the United States. So that was the premise for funding Dr. Gordon's program, which is called Collaborative Pathway, and it's part of an organization called Advocates Incorporated. And it's now been going, I think, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, maybe even longer. Chris is one of my favorite psychiatrists. Chris is just an amazing guy. He and I were just talking yesterday. He's probably going to be taking even more of a leadership role with the foundation. I won't get into that right now. But Chris,
hey,
uses
listen,
terms
before
like
I forget, creative. Would you send me and him a joint email introducing me to him and him to me?
Absolutely.
I'd love to have him on the show.
Yeah, I'd be honored to have him. I'm talking with him about doing some other educational pieces for me. So, yeah, I would be honored to connect two of my favorite psychiatrists in the whole world. So, Peter, there are good psychiatrists around, okay?
Well, you've named two.
That's right. Yeah, name some more, huh? I'll work on that.
There are certainly a few. I know a few others in the U.S. and a few others around the world. But they have had to confront, you know, the establishment in order to do good work, and they've all come under a great deal of criticism, and a number of them, you know, I could bring the numbers up to, you know, more, but they're working totally undercover in private practice and don't.
Yeah.
Take the risk of speaking out, which to me is totally understandable. There are not many people who think that they're, you know, under orders to do this kind of work. You're doing great work there. I mean, would you like to talk some more about the foundation? We also have on our agenda for you to talk about your latest blog on Madden America too, which has a lot of good things in it and some good observations.
Before I do that, I wanted to finish off one other piece that's fairly late-breaking news. Another adaptation of Open Dialogue is going to be starting soon in Atlanta, Georgia. Peter, I don't even know if I've told you about this, but it's going to have a research component connected through Emory University. And again, about an hour and a half ago, I heard that there are about 10 or 12 other agencies that are interested in how they might play a useful role in this. So I don't want to get too giddy or optimistic, but I do think there are some cracks in the system where I think there are people who are realizing that the way we've been practicing psychiatry isn't getting the results that people really need. So I think there's some reason to be hopeful when we see the expansion of projects like Open Dialogue into Framingham, Massachusetts, and now into a big city in the South. So it'll be interesting to see how that process unfolds. I'll keep you posted on it.
Do you, Bob Nickel, do you, by the way, Nickel is spelled N-I-K-K-E-L. It's Robert Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L. And you can find him on the web pretty easily because there's just not a lot of Bob Nickels around in the U.S. Maybe in Europe. But there's not a ton of them here, are there, Bob Nickels?
Peter, I have to tell you a quick story. There is another Bob Nickel that I've connected with. A couple of years ago, I started getting invitations to go on yacht trips up in the Puget Sound. And I thought, this isn't what social workers usually get invited to do. So to make a long story short, there's actually an oilman in Oklahoma whose name is Bob Nickel. And we probably are distant relatives. But we connected, and it turns out that his daughter was going into social work. So I've actually had a chance to get acquainted with the other Bob Nickel and a little bit of his family. So there is another Bob Nickel. But if you Google Robert Nickel and put Mad in America, you'll pop into my, I think I've got about 10 or 12 blogs that I've written on the Mad in America website.
It's very worthwhile doing. And again, if you're not familiar with the Mad in America website, it's really worth looking at. Now, Bob Whitaker, and also definitely Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, put out a broad umbrella. So you're going to find things on Mad in America that just make my stomach churn with the attempt to have a big umbrella. And some of the programs covered by Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health are not exactly my cup of tea. Other than mentioning it, I just don't care. I think that there's a very good reason that Bob Whitaker and Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health do a broader umbrella. I think it helps enormously in them getting the word out on the critical issues that we all share a common belief in. And I just think that both these groups are doing wonderful, wonderful work. And I'm happy to blog on Mad in America. Happy to be there. Bob, are you up to date enough? I mean, you're busy and I don't expect you to be, but are you up to date enough to tell us how far the developments in Framingham have gone in developing this model and actually putting it into practice? Are you up to date on the latest details?
I'm not up to date on the latest details. I know that they've been operating the program now for, I think it's over 2 years. I'd have to go back and double check on that. It may be longer. But I think Chris would be a good person to have on your program. I think he'd be very interested in telling more about exactly what it looks like, their success. I have no doubt that they're going to be successful with people, and they're already being successful. I think what we ought to be looking at is about an 80% success rate in the sense of getting people back into school and working. And right now, I would say the figures are inverted. We only have about 20% success rate if it's even that, getting people their lives back. Young people, I'm talking about, who have their first, you know, whatever you want to call it, psychotic episode. We can talk about different terms for it, yeah. Extreme state.
Well, this 80% success rate, folks, may sound astonishing since pretty much psychiatry knows that schizophrenia is a chronic illness and nobody gets better. They don't know it's because of the treatments that nobody gets better, or if they know it, they don't want to admit it, which I think is more and more likely now that they know it, but they don't want to admit it. 80% is real. That I don't know about the Framingham Project, but it's in that range, and the carefully researched, followed up 5 and 10 year kinds of follow ups on the finished program, open dialogue. And you can get those papers by putting in Googling scientific papers, open dialogue. Just write down that scientific papers, open dialogue, and you'll get some of the papers that have been published and be able to track down the others. And it's my experience in my practice that if a young person is brought to me with a cooperative family, and let's say they've just dropped out of their sophomore year in college and they're hallucinating and hiding in their bed and terrified, and if the parents are willing to work and will come in and establish more loving, caring communication, that youngster's going to go back to college after the next summer. So, you know, this is my experience, and it's the experience of other good therapists who and good patience. You know, it takes both patience and willing, for hardworking patients and therapists to accomplish things. But in general, people do want to get better. And when they're put into a good program where they haven't already been injured by psychiatry, the rates of success are very high, because what people who are psychotic need are good, solid relationships to bring them back to trusting another human being and back to reality. And if it can be done with older people in the context of a marriage, if it can be done with younger people in the context of their parents and family, you can do miraculous work. You can see big changes after just a few hour session working with a family, with somebody who's deeply disturbed, whether it's, you know, manifesting as a disabling anxiety or disabling guilt and shame, or, you know, what gets diagnosed as depression and so on. Anything more, yeah, Bob, about the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health or these other programs you're doing? You're such good programs.
Well, the tagline, if you look at our business cards for the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care and turn over the card and look on the back, it has two words. And I will accept credit for this, because I was the one that proposed this and it was accepted. And those two words are expect recovery. So my view of things is that we ought to expect people to get better with their lives. By that I mean not just, maybe they'll still have a few what we call symptoms, but that's not the measure. The measure should be, are they able to get back to work or school and lead a reasonably happy, productive life? That's, you know, in essence what recovery is. But we should expect nothing less than an 80% success rate. And I'll also say this. I have to put in a plug for looking at alcohol and drug issues. Many of the young people who are having these extreme states are also struggling with alcohol and drug issues. And that's something that sometimes gets overlooked. And I think sometimes the 20% that we're struggling with, maybe we haven't quite figured out how alcohol and drugs are impacting all of that.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I've heard all kinds of wild claims on helping people with alcohol and drug addiction, but I think it's incredibly difficult. And I do some work in that area in my practice. The people who come to me have good families, you know, they come in fairly early. So if I have success, it has a lot to do with the circumstance. You know, helping people who have been injuring themselves with street drugs and alcohol for a long time, it is very hard to help them. They go through a lot of suffering surrounding the drugs and coming off the drugs they're using. Do you have any program that's aimed at that right now?
Yeah, I'm not entirely comfortable with the name of it, but when I was state mental health and addictions commissioner, I helped start seeding funding for a peer support organization called Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. This was a 12-step program that got started by a guy who was a Vietnam veteran. He came back, he got hooked on heroin, and he had PTSD. He got himself into recovery, and he started working as an alcohol and drug counselor, and he had a particular love for people who had mental health issues. And so he would try to take them to regular NA and AA meetings, and he'd usually get a call back and saying, that person's a little too weird, don't bring him back. So instead of moping and complaining about it, he went out and started Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. We started funding it in Oregon during my tenure. We now have meetings in virtually every county in Oregon. We have meetings in 17 other states. We just opened our first meetings in London and five other countries. I understand there's a meeting in Prague, Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic. So these are our peer support groups, and I think that's really one of the great answers to dealing with many of the issues that we're dealing with that we're not being successful with otherwise. And again, I think peer supports are an overlooked area in many professional environments. People who've been there, done that, have a much better feel for what it's like to get into recovery than many of us who haven't necessarily had both experiences.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Are you developing any programs that would establish certify people in psychotherapy without their having to get all the higher degrees. That is one of my goals. I'm going to be talking with a friend of mine about that this weekend, who's coming to visit me and who is interested in helping develop certification programs for people to deliver at an early stage before catastrophe hits, to deliver guidance and therapy services to people. Do you know of any good works going on in that area that would inspire me when I talk with my visitor this weekend? Are you doing any?
I'm not aware of anything off the top of my head. I know that there are more and more peers that are working toward getting certification and even continuing education approaches for people who are peer service and peer support workers. So that's the closest that I've been dealing with it for people who don't have the so-called advanced degrees.
Well, that's something I wasn't aware of. So that's interesting. So that peers are trying to establish peer counseling people, and peer helpers are trying to establish themselves on a more serious or professional level. I hope they don't get corrupted.
Right.
And having training programs and so on. That's interesting.
Well, yeah, I think there's some risk involved in so-called professionalizing this group of people. But there are 45 states, I understand, that have a certification process of some kind. And so it was people who were involved with that around the country, INAPS, International Association for Peer Supports, I think is the name of it. I've been in touch with them, and we're not doing anything with that right now with the Madden America Continuing Education Project. But we're looking at is a future potential. But the idea there is to have some kind of better organized continuing education courses that would help people do a better job and also keep their certification processes in those states that have them.
Do you want to take – I thought we'd spend half an hour or more on the following subject. Do you want to comment some on the blog that you've recently put up on Mad in America? I found it interesting. I mean, basically a conference looking at psychiatry in the media, as I remember, and there were a lot of bright and intelligent people there and cutting-edge people, and they had very conventional ideas about psychiatry, I gather. Your observations on that and any correction of what I've just said?
No, that's essentially what it was. It was actually not just media, but films as a subset of media. Peter, you know this, but I've been involved with the Dean Brooks family for many years. And Dr. Dean Brooks was the superintendent and a very humane man. For 27 years was superintendent of Oregon State Hospital from 1955 to 1982. He was the hospital administrator that allowed the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to be filmed at Oregon State Hospital. He got a lot of flack for it. But because of the association with his movie and his family, we've been involved with the Sachs Institute in Southern California, University of Southern California. So their most recent symposium was held on mental, I think the title was Mental Illness in the Movies. Mental Illness in Cinema. I have the agenda right in front of me now. So the goal of that one was simply to talk about how people with mental health issues have been portrayed in movies over the years. I won't need to go into detail on what the content of the discussions were about, but what struck me was the conventional ideas that this very well-educated group of people, many filmmakers in the L.A. area, many attorneys, even a few mental health people and family members, have very conventional notions that, for example, the term chemical imbalance came up over and over and over again. And despite the fact that we don't know anything about what a chemical imbalance would look like, there are no tests for it. And Peter, you've been on this wagon for a long time. But if there's no chemical imbalance that's being restored by medications, then what are we really talking about? But what struck me was how so many well-educated people, without examining those concepts, have bought into them. There's a whole culture of thinking about mental health issues that really needs to be challenged, I think. So the blog that I wrote has, and I won't go into all of them, a series of what I consider to be misconceptions. And then just as important in driving the misconception are missing pieces of information. Some of the missing pieces of information are things like we talked about Martin Harrow's studies. What do the long-term outcome studies really show about the relationship between time, psychiatric drugs, et cetera, et cetera? So that's the nature of the blog. I got some flack for referring to people who were at the symposium as the best and the brightest. But my feeling is that we can't impugn the motives of everybody if we're going to really try to change how the world looks in this. And we've got to give people credit for being intelligent, but simply missing some pieces of information because they haven't been readily available. You know, if I had asked people in this audience whether they'd ever heard of you, Peter, or Bob Whitaker, or Peter Getza, I'm sure that maybe one out of 150 people who attended would ever have even heard of you, okay? So I think people simply aren't getting exposed to the kind of information that you're talking about on your radio program that you've been, frankly, talking about for years and years and years. And when they do hear about it, they hear that, you know, we're out in left field, we're anti-psychiatry, that we're angry. Well, some of those things may be true, but that doesn't discount what we've been talking about. But the point here is that I think we have to say people can have the best of intentions, be very intelligent, but have been misled by the information that they haven't had access to. And frankly, by the countering of that information by the pharmaceutical companies, who I think have really affected the culture and people's cultural expectations and knowledge about what we're dealing with.
Yes, I think that the pharmaceutical industry has changed our culture more deeply than anybody has grasped, including me. I don't think I can quite grasp because I just don't have the knowledge. But everywhere I look, the pharmaceutical industry has its tentacles. And this biochemical imbalance idea, I think that in some ways it's a religious construct. Because if you ask those 100 people at this conference, do they believe in God? And most of them would say no. If you ask them, do they have a deep faith of any kind? Most of them would say no. If you ask them, you know, what sort of great ideals they have, they would be flummoxed. And things like biochemical imbalance become their explanations for their own suffering and failure because they no longer have a better idea, a grander idea, a motivating or inspiring idea to live by. Folks, we've been talking with Bob Nickel, a man I love very, very much. His last name is spelled N-I-K-K-E-L. You can easily find him on the internet. And you can do it even more easily if you connect it to Madden America. He's got a very interesting blog where he just sort of lays out, it would help you in dealing with people, he lays out all the many fallacies of modern psychiatry. He does it in a kind way. My blog is one of the most passionate, which is also you can find on Madden America right now. It's one of the most passionate things I ever have written about my outrage and pain of euthanasia returning on such a scale, somewhat in America and even more in Europe. And I provide a link to an article I published in a medical journal years ago about how German psychiatry independently created the first Holocaust of mental patients that prepared the way for the Holocaust on a wider scale. Thank you, Bob Nickel. We are saying goodbye.
Thank you, Peter.